Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Alexandra Ortolia-Baird, a host of the channel, and today I'm joined by Devin Vartia to discuss his new book, The Color of Equality, Race and Common Humanity in Enlightenment Thought, published by University of Pennsylvania Press in 2021. Devin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a really, really exciting book that I think has a huge amount to offer listeners from across a wide variety of disciplines. But before we start digging into the content of The Color of Equality, Devin, I wonder if you could tell listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to work on this topic of race and common humanity in Enlightenment thought.
Sure. So I guess the deeper origins of this book lie in my time as an undergrad at McMaster University in Canada, near where I'm from. I took an interdisciplinary bachelor program called Arts and Science. And when I first started that program, I was actually more interested in the natural sciences. But I was quickly just very drawn to the exciting questions that were being asked and the discussions that we were having in our humanities and social sciences courses. And we had, it was a very kind of old school, traditional curriculum in certain ways. I mean, in the sense that one of the courses that I liked the most was called Western Civilization, which is, of course, you know, not something that, you know, isn't really, you know, it's kind of falling by the wayside now. During that course, I mean, I was just so fascinated by the place of the Enlightenment in European or Western history. And I was just really taken with the promise of emancipation that Enlightenment held for people. And that really just captured my imagination as an undergrad, such that by the time I started my master's degree, which I did at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, and also my PhD at Utrecht University, I was just elated when I heard a lecture from a scholar named Siep Sturmum, who became my doctoral advisor. He gave a lecture on the contradictory legacy of the Enlightenment in terms of a very forceful notion of equality, at the same time that Enlightenment thinkers, you know, had invented what he calls modern discourses of inequality, of which race is a very prominent one. And that just, you know, he's a very eloquent speaker, and he is, after he gave his lecture, I was just like, that's it. That's what I have to do my research on. And I at the time, I didn't know that I didn't have any plans actually even to do a PhD, but I just really fell in love. I mean, university had been just such an eye-opener for me. I came from a rural conservative area of Canada, and family as well, and it was just such an opening for me, the undergrad and then the master's even more so, and so I just, it just really it just all sort of came together so nicely, this advisor at the university, the topic, so that became my the topic of my PhD research, which I did over the course of about 4.5-5 years at Utrecht University, and then that was polished into this book during my time as a postdoctoral fellow at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. After which I began as an assistant professor at Utrecht University. So that's where I've been working for just over a year now as assistant professor in political history in the history department. So so hopefully that gives a bit of a sense of sort of where this came from and why I'm so excited about it.
And it's interesting that you mentioned this interest that you had in the natural sciences, because that certainly feels like it resonates within the book a little bit. I think you can see some of those threads clearly crossing over between social and natural sciences.
Good to hear.
No, certainly. I just want to kind of offer to listeners just a forewarning before we start jumping into the actual content of the book, that there will be the use of some examples of historic racialized language within this interview. And just to kind of note that this will purely be used in reference to verbatim quotations from Enlightenment writings, and that these will be contextualized. But we just wanted to make that clear from the start. So on that note, Devin, what I'd like to do is kind of touch upon where you start with the book. And that is that you start with a problem. And that problem is that thinkers of the Enlightenment, and I quote here, they politicized the concept of equality while simultaneously making the naturalization of inequalities between Europeans and non-Europeans thinkable. Now, for those who are perhaps a little less familiar with this tension, or we might even say perceived tension, could you perhaps just start by telling us a little bit about how this dichotomy or this tension has been kind of broadly conceived or viewed by historians and scholars to date?
Yeah, excellent. So I guess for much of the history of the historiography of the Enlightenment, so the scholarship on the Enlightenment as a historical, both a philosophical and a historical phenomenon, I would say has mainly been focused on the Enlightenment as the origins of modernity, and especially the origins of the ideals that are central to modern liberal democracies. There's a very strong tradition going back, really to the 19th century, but especially the 20th century in the post-Second World War II period, in this vein of looking at the Enlightenment as the source of ideals of religious toleration, freedom in the political realm, anti-slavery, therefore, intimately connected to that, notions of equality before the law, a secular human science, really, with all of the positive and negative things that came out of that. But mostly, I would say, in this tradition that I'm talking about, it was, of course, a story of triumph, really, of, humankind's exit from superstition. And if only things were so simple and so straightforward, but luckily for me and for many people, I think that it's a lot more interesting and complicated than that, of course, of sort of this trajectory of progress that we inherited from the Enlightenment. And so I think one of the quote that you just mentioned from my book is alludes to the legacy, mostly, I think, of the challenge, we could say postmodern challenge, to the Enlightenment that arose in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, in terms of looking at the Enlightenment from a very different angle and different lens, and interpreting its legacy from a very different position, one of actually control, oppression. This has, roots in older roots in Horkheimer and Adorno's critique of the Enlightenment from the 1940s. But I think it really sort of takes off in a way that it didn't in the 40s, from sort of the 70s and 80s. with not only postmodernism, I would say, but just in general, sort of the democratization of the humanities and the social sciences after the Second World War, when women and minorities start to study these issues and draw attention to the fact that what had been so often interpreted as a universalist and kind of emancipatory tradition, i.e., the Enlightenment leading to the French Revolution, leading to modern liberal democracy, that there's another story that can be told here, which is one of the justification of the oppression of non-white or non-European peoples using a scientific language, pseudoscience, obviously, but for the thinkers of the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries who were practicing this, this was anything but pseudoscience. It was really scientific for them. And so the problem is as I've just set it out. So it's a, to a certain extent, a historiographical one in the sense that we still are living with the tensions between, postmodernism obviously doesn't raise the hackles that it did in the, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but still, I don't think we've come yet to really sort of integrate what we gained from that critique of the emancipatory tradition and legacy of the Enlightenment with the power of the perspective of ways, new forms of social control and oppression that arose from within the Enlightenment. I don't think that we've really come to appreciate sort of how we can bring these two perspectives together. In part, I see my book as an attempt to do just that, to sort of say, okay, well, we have now by now four decades of critique of the Enlightenment. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fundamental contribution to the history of human emancipation that the Enlightenment contributed to. So this is partially what I'm trying to do in the book, is to honestly and as thoroughly as possible take both sides into account. In a contextualist manner, and that perhaps we can talk about it later, but the contextualism is where I see where we can really make sense of the tensions that I've just laid out.
And so to do that, you focus on three encyclopedias of the Enlightenment. So you have Chambers' Encyclopedia, you've got the Encyclopedia of Diderot and d'Alembert, and finally you then come to the Encyclopedia di Vardon of Fortunato de Felice. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to, over the course of this hour, talk about these in greater depth, but I was wondering, just to begin with, if you could maybe explain a little bit about why you chose this very particular genre of the Enlightenment to think about, that tension that you've already talked about, but also these, larger questions of race and humanity during the long 18th century.
Right. Yeah. So partially because these books form a genealogy that cover a fairly large geographical area and a temporal scope of Enlightenment Europe. Ephraim Chambers' Encyclopedia, published in London in 1728, was considered sort of the first modern encyclopedia because it was published in alphabetical order, and it was it incorporated Newtonian science and a Lockean epistemology. Now I think that's quite up for debate, and rightly so. I mean, alphabetical order has a much longer history than that, and we don't have to go in depth about what was the first modern encyclopedia. But in any case, it was immensely popular, I think the fact that it was formed part of the consolidation of Newtonian science is extremely important. Race has a lot to do with developments from. As it developed as a concept in the 18th century, has a lot to do with developments and concerns that arose because of the new science and the new philosophy associated, of course, very very much so with Newton. So that was that's for the racial side, but also for in terms of thinking about equality. I mean, I think that there's also a good reason to include or to start a history with Chambers, because he explicitly addresses in his preface people who artisans, so people who are not just a part of the learned elite, that he hopes that his book will be helpful to them. And of course, you know, again, this was not completely new, but I think that it was certainly quite novel for an encyclopedia to make such claims that even you know, not the highly educated elite will find such a book of use. So I started with Chambers. And then, I guess I should also add just the very idea of looking at encyclopedias should probably be explained more so than I have done up until now, which is just that it allowed me to make a very broad topic to give it some scope and to make it more doable and tangible. And of course, encyclopedias were immensely popular and important texts in the early modern period, and really encapsulated, as other scholars have pointed out, some of the essential principles of the Enlightenment, i.e., the goal of sharing knowledge openly, accessibly, opening up a conversation. I think that encyclopedias were instrumental herein, and so. So that's Chambers, and then Diderot and d'Alembert, their monumental encyclopédie project, which started in the 1740s, and the first volume was published in 1751. That actually started out as a translation of Ephraim Chambers' encyclopedia. So, I had noticed in the historiography that people there actually hasn't really been a very close study of how Chambers was used, or how rather I should begin differently, so how Diderot, d'Alembert, and their collaborators used Ephraim Chambers' encyclopedia. So I thought that, oh, well, this is a great opportunity to then also contribute to that vein of scholarship of the recycling of encyclopedic material, and therefore to sort of really get at, you can really do a very close analysis to see exactly what the authors changed in the translations. And then ask, of course, why did they change it in such a way? And that'll come up, I think, in later in our discussion, because there are fascinating changes to articles pertinent to thinking about equality and race in this period. And so using encyclopedias allowed me to really do this sort of fine-grained analysis of, okay, given that, as other scholars have pointed out, copying is a law of lexicographical work, so the work of dictionary. So it's banal to say that, you know, dictionary definitions stay pretty stable over fairly long periods of time. So then when changes do happen, it's actually quite significant, and we should really be looking closely at why those at how a definition changes. And why. And then, of course, I mean, not only definitions, but I mean, these articles were, you know, they weren't dictionaries, they're encyclopedias. So often these articles, were arguments, you know, they were little mini essays, really, many of the articles that I analyzed, especially in the Francophone encyclopedias that I analyzed. So then with Diderot and d'Alembert, I could not only compare very closely with Chambers, but I could also just, of course, tap into the monumental moment that was mid-18th century Paris in terms of the history of the Enlightenment as a whole, and really get at, you know, these two strands of thought that were in tension with each other, and just really look at what was going on among this group of Enlightenment thinkers, the French encyclopedists. And then the choice for the Swiss one might be a little bit surprising, but it was actually a very popular encyclopedia in Protestant Europe. It was published in Yverdon, which is near Bern, and it was actually under Bern's in Bernese territory in Switzerland. And the editor De Felice had contacts with a bookseller in the Dutch Republic in The Hague. And so it actually made its way quickly to the Dutch Republic, which had, of course, a large minority of French-speaking Protestants who had fled after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, and so there was a clear market for this. And the group of encyclopedists that De Felice assembled around himself were all basically all of them were Protestants, were what I've called liberal Protestants. So they were, you know, what they can be included in a tradition of Christian, Protestant Christian Enlightenment. And so this became a fascinating window into how religion then affects the thinking about equality and race. So I could really, with these encyclopedias, I could take a temporal scope that was sufficiently long to see interesting changes, and then also though look at the political, philosophical, and religious contours of this debate, because they were, you know, very complex, of course, and it's a fascinating jumble of ideas and traditions, and sort of that, and so that this set of primary sources allowed me to take all of this on board.
And we're certainly going to come back to talking about De Felice, because, you know, he and his group, I think, are often quite overlooked when we're talking about the Enlightenment more generally. But as your book makes very clear, they play an incredibly important and fascinating role. Yeah. So the book kind of moves in its first chapters to you obviously move on to kind of later think about the evolution, about the concept of equality and how that looks within the various encyclopedias. But before you get to that, I think you make a really fantastic contribution, which is kind of thinking about that longer early modern history of discussions regarding sameness and difference and how that kind of develops into racial thinking and language and classification and so on. And I was wondering, because this is an area that has had quite a degree of debate, we might say, among historians. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little about how historians have thought about this longer history of race and sameness and difference, and perhaps, you know, where you position the book in terms of this longer term discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, I guess for race started to become a really important axis of analysis, I would say, in for historians and other scholars. I would say roughly from the 60s and 70s, especially the 70s onwards, linked to, as I mentioned earlier, the democratization of higher education across the Western world. And of course, this brought us so much. I mean, it was, as I said before, that the tradition, especially of looking at the Enlightenment, had been one of just looking at it as a universalist tradition with truly universalist implications, and really ignoring the racialism and racism of a wide variety of Enlightenment thinkers. And I mean, not only with the Enlightenment, I mean, race became such an important, I mean, there are different genealogies, of course, you can use. I mean, obviously, there were scholars working on race long before this, but I'm just, let's stick to the Enlightenment, to my area of expertise. And I think that when it comes to early modern history and the Enlightenment, then from the 1970s onwards, you see that the concept of othering, just in general, but of course is very much related to race, obviously, becomes immensely important for making sense of how the Western canon developed and just how European history as such developed. So there are numerous studies that make clear the Eurocentric assumptions that went into so much of the canon, let's say, of European thought, and so that's been immensely important scholarship, and for the way that I see my book in this trajectory is that we've this has been immensely enriching, but we shouldn't forget that equality isn't something that we can just take for granted. This is something that my advisor, Siep Sturman, really argues forcefully in his book, The Invention of Humanity, Equality and Cultural Difference in World History, is that the underlying assumption in much scholarship, let's say in the othering tradition, is that equality is the sort of default position. And I think that's very much true. It should be the case, of course, that equality is the default position. But we can't take that for granted. We have to see how equality is not an obvious feature of the natural or the social and cultural world, how it had to be conjured up. It had to be invented and fought for this in various ways and in various times. And so what I try to do in the book is I draw on Sturman's scholarship to highlight the fact that one of the things that made equality so different and exciting in the 18th century Enlightenment is that it starts to gain the benefit of the doubt. That it that for a variety of very complex reasons, the default assumption, rather than being one of basic and essential inequality, starts to be one of equality. And the inequalities that are so inherent in the social and cultural world call out for greater attention and greater explanation. And so this is sort of the fundamental shift, I think, that makes the one of the fundamental shifts that makes the Enlightenment so fascinating to study is sort of why this happened and how this happened. And again, it doesn't exclude ways of thinking about inequality or ways of or systems of oppression. So that's very important to emphasize here. This is sort of how I position the book in what you've just mentioned about the longer history of using race as a category of analysis in relationship to equality, race, and othering, this complex.
And so you move then to talk about the first of the encyclopedias, and this is Ephraim Chambers' Cyclopedia of 1728. You've mentioned it kind of very briefly, but I was wondering if you could maybe give us a little bit of background to the Cyclopedia and what specifically were its aims. You know, you've spoken about it being this, I guess, kind of almost apogee of Enlightenment kind of encyclopedism, but what specifically was the Cyclopedia kind of aiming to do, and how did that manifest itself in its pages?
Yeah. So I think most importantly for Ephraim Chambers was Newtonian science. So he really wanted to make Newtonian science accessible to as wide an audience as possible, as a worldview, and also as a even as something that started to have technological very great technological implications. So we're talking. So he was actually didn't come from a very wealthy family, and was apprenticed to a bookseller and globemaker in London, and in London he was connected to a group of Freemasons. So this is sort of, you know, the time period in which Freemasonry starts to become an important part of the history of the Enlightenment as, you know, a sphere of sociability outside of the church and state, which had obviously, you know, very egalitarian aspects to it. So in terms of, you know, the membership to a certain extent, you know, we shouldn't overdo that, but at least, you know, it had a fairly broad membership in terms of socioeconomic status of its members, and even in some cases religious background, so that it brought together people of various religious stripes. So this is the word. He was actually the master of the Grand Lodge in London for a time, and it is through that milieu that he came into contact, for example, with Benjamin Franklin. Most likely, we don't have, I think, correspondence here, but we have indirect evidence in the sense that Benjamin Franklin used some of Ephraim Chambers' articles in his Pennsylvania Gazette back in the colonies of the Americas. And so this is the milieu from which he's coming, and the book was very popular. So there was a longer tradition of books that were aimed at, let's say, a broader audience than just the learned elite. So Harris's Lexicon Technicum, I think, if I remember correctly, is the one of the important predecessors of Ephraim Chambers. So this was also sort of a handy summary of new developments, in technology and science. And this is a really important part, I think, of how we should understand Ephraim Chambers' encyclopedia, was that it wasn't a confident summa of all of human knowledge, as many encyclopedias, back into the Middle Ages were, or at least claimed to be and hoped to be. I think he was very aware of the fact that, you know, this was a work that would be superseded as new knowledge is gained, as, you know, very much a part of the Lockean and Newtonian traditions. And so that's what I think one of the most important aspects of the work. Also, of course, the financial aspects shouldn't go unmentioned, in the sense that it was published at a time when the book trade was obviously very commercialized, and so he hoped obviously to make a profit, and that he very much did. It was a very popular book, so it was published by subscription, as English books were published already from the 17th century. And after the first edition, publishers were assured of their sales, so they didn't even require a subscription list because it was just so popular. An Italian translation was published quite quickly. A French translation, of course, began in the 1740s, obviously, with Diderot and D'Alembert. And part of how we can make sense of the content of that book is this milieu of the early Enlightenment sphere of a growing civil society centered around the Masonic lodges, in which, you know, religious affiliation is very much in transformation, such that Ephraim Chambers was most likely a deist, and he very much promotes religious toleration, which, as I argue in the book, is connected to a certain conception of equality.
And then you go on to explore quite a variety of ways in which the encyclopedia engaged with ideas of equality more generally. But I think one of the really important examples that you draw attention to is how the word, and I quote here, the word Negro is used. And this is not just in the article entry specifically entitled Negro, but also throughout and in other articles as well. And I was wondering if you could maybe expand on this a little bit about what this use of this particular word tells us about ideas of race and equality at this, as you kind of identify, very early stage of the Enlightenment, and as you've just, you know, revealed to us, you know, this kind of context relating to Masonry, perhaps also the financial endeavors and so on. So this, I think this would be a really interesting example to unpick if you would do us so kindly.
Of course, yeah. So the article Negro is interesting because it reveals, I think, the two traditions or discourses in which this word and concept became of greater importance throughout the 18th century. And of course, the first thing to say here is the context of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade and the growth of slave societies in the New World. Because the first thing that he says in that article, Negro, is that he says a kind of slave. This is in both English and French, starting already in the second half of the 17th century, these slave and Negro start to become synonyms in a way that they never were before. This is obviously indicative of the fast-growing importance of the institution of slavery to the European economy, and then the effects that it has on culture and thought, etc. This is very, very clear. This is reflected in Chambers' Encyclopedia. The language of commerce and the status of Black peoples as chattel in the European worldview, to a growing extent in the European worldview throughout the 18th century. And alongside that, I also point to the natural historical discourse. So the making sense of Blackness and whiteness, but whiteness was almost always considered just the unspoken standard. And so Blackness also largely because of the institution of slavery starts to become a phenomenon that European thinkers think needs to be explained in physiological terms and in natural historical terms. And so these are the two discourses that I point to explain the growing significance of the term. What's interesting, though, is that these discourses develop alongside one another in such a way that the natural historical exploration and explanation of Blackness does not in any simple one-to-one way develop as a justification of slavery. So it's important to mention, because of what we'll talk about with the Francophone encyclopedias, this discourse is much more highly developed, or this field of thought, rather the discourse of natural history, the natural history of humanity, not only the natural history of Black people or Blackness, but just the natural history of humanity as a whole, is much more highly developed. But some of those thinkers are quite fiercely anti-slavery. So this is just something important to mention. But nonetheless, I think with Chambers, and then with the supplement to Chambers that I also used, which was published in 1753, you can see that the discourse of commerce and the status of Black people as chattel, in the slave system, that only becomes more prominent. At the same time that new experiments are being performed to investigate the cause of Blackness. So these things very much develop in tandem. And as I said, it's a complex relationship between them, but we definitely have to consider them together.
And so, as you've just mentioned, you then move to talk about what is perhaps one of the most famous products of the Enlightenment, and that's the Encyclopédie of Diderot and d'Alembert. And, many, as you've already also have mentioned, will know that, the Encyclopédie was begun as a translation of Chambers' Encyclopedia, but as you then explore in the book, it was very much more than that, and it vastly expanded on Chambers' original project, on the articles, on the aims and ambitions and so on. And one of the core developments that you really tackle in the book is about the evolution of ideas of natural equality and rights within the Encyclopédie. And in short, you say that this is the transformation of equality into a political concept.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could maybe, tell us a little bit about this shift and why that's such an important one to think about, this transformation of equality into a political concept.
Sure. Yeah, of course. So I think this is important, I think, because equality has such a long history, obviously going back to the ancients. And what I found so fascinating is that equality could be stated as a fact, but it had very few consequences for many thinkers throughout the Western tradition from antiquity. It had very few consequences, real political or social consequences. So I found this just so fascinating that it could be stated as a fact and really, you know, in quite forceful terms. But then the thinker or set of thinkers or the text could go on to take the institution of slavery, for example, as a perfectly justifiable institution. And I found this just so fascinating that you could state equality as a fact and even to a certain extent as a good, and then go on to accept slavery. So what I wanted to explore partially in the book is why only in certain times and places does the statement all human beings are created equal have real egalitarian political consequences in certain times and places. And this is what I see, why I see the Enlightenment and more specifically Diderot and D'Alembert's Encyclopédie to be important, not because it was totally thoroughgoingly egalitarian text, whatever that might mean. I mean, that's obviously an anachronism, but the point that I wanted to make in that chapter is that you see that equality is used in ways that it was never used in European reference works before. Namely, in that Jaucourt, for example, Louis de Jaucourt, the most prolific encyclopedist, he writes in his article, Natural Equality, he draws on Pufendorf, Samuel Pufendorf, the 17th century natural law thinker. And Pufendorf is one of these thinkers that fits into what I've just said about a thinker who, you know, in his natural law texts, he's very clear that we are all created equal in the image of God. There are certain consequences that result from that. We have to approach each other as equal. But he then goes on to write that even hereditary slavery is something that doesn't violate natural equality. And what's so fascinating is that for a thinker like Jaucourt, it does violate natural equality, the institution of slavery. So he's clear. So in the article Natural Equality, he doesn't actually specifically address like transatlantic chattel slavery. He does so in other articles, but in that he does address though the profound inequalities of his 18th century, you know, contemporary French society, in the sense that he says, you know, it is the violation of this principle that leads to the groaning of the vast majority of people under extreme conditions of extreme poverty. And it's, you know, it's very clear that he's critical of those conditions. He, you know, granted, he does say, okay, don't accuse me of being an extreme supporter of absolute equality. And many historians have pointed to that to sort of highlight the limitations that Enlightenment thinkers placed on equality. And I see this quite differently, precisely because this article was the only article, one of the earliest articles to tackle equality as not just a mathematical and logical concept, but as a concept in the social and political spheres. And so the very presence of it, I find just fascinating. And then to sort of see what he does with it. So yes, he does have this caveat of, you know, don't accuse me of being a supporter of absolute equality. But he then says, I will leave it to the reader to decide what other consequences follow from the concept of natural equality. So it's fascinating that he's very attuned to the fact that there's a certain logic within equality that allows, there's sort of an expansionary logic to it. And he's very aware of that. And to an extent that I think, you know, Pufendorf absolutely was not, because we know from other scholarship that he actually lamented, Pufendorf, even the fact that slavery had been abolished in Europe. So, you know, it's just fascinating that we of course then should try to understand why Pufendorf thought the way that he thought. And I think that has to do with a certain conception of autonomy, that there are certain groups of people who are incapable of autonomous thought and action, and what is interesting is that by the time we get to Jaucourt and his collaborators, some of them, not all of them, of course, but because we do find pro-slavery articles in the Encyclopédie, but the main thrust of sort of the core contributors is one of politicizing equality. And this is what I wanted to highlight in regard to slavery and anti-slavery thought, and in regard to gender to a certain extent, and the idea of a sexual hierarchy, and religious toleration and political absolutism, that equality plays an essential role in all of these realms in critiquing all of these traditions.
I think what's so interesting in this chapter in particular, and about the Encyclopédie and its contributors more generally, is that there doesn't seem to be this coherent philosophical standpoint on these issues. In fact, there does seem to be quite a plurality of views regarding equality, and these are kind of accepted. It seems to be okay within the Encyclopédie that there would be this plurality of views. So I was wondering if you might perhaps give us an example of where this plurality manifests itself. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe the articles of Le Roman, potentially, mm-hmm. and perhaps explain a little bit about what this dissonance means in terms of, you know, how we actually can read and interpret the Encyclopédie when it comes to issues like race, like equality, and so on.
Right. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. I mean, that's part of what makes it so fascinating, is this eclecticism. And then sort of funnily enough, Diderot, one of the most famous articles is Diderot's article Eclecticisme, so that's quite interesting. There's a veritable cacophony of voices when it comes to these issues of race and equality, and that's part of what makes it so interesting to study. And to give a very specific example, I think you're absolutely right that Le Romain, so Jean-Baptiste Pierre Le Romain, if I remember correctly, was the author of a number of articles on slavery and the New World, various aspects of colonial society. If I remember correctly, he wrote the article on sugar refineries. But in my book, most important, I engage with him because he wrote one of the entries for Negros. There are four entries under the headword Negro, and he wrote the article "Negro Considered as Slaves in the Colonies of America of the Americas" is the full headword of that article. And as you can obviously glean from the headword, it was it's an astonishing a racist summary of colonial slave masters' perceptions of sub-Saharan African peoples. And it's just provides an overview of the various regions of Africa where enslaved peoples came from, the ethnicities, he goes into the characteristics of various sub-Saharan African ethnicities and what they, according to him, excelled at, or what their main, characteristics were. And so it's just a really, confrontational a piece in which you see sort of the centrality of slavery to European culture and the development of, states really in this time period. And what's fascinating is that this exists alongside a thinker like Jaucourt, who was so vehemently anti-slavery, in addition to Diderot and a handful of others, but especially Jaucourt and Diderot, these two perspectives that are so at odds with one another are in the same encyclopedia. And the way that scholars have, scholars seemed in general, this is sort of a bit oversimplifying, but scholars seem to have approached this in kind of one of two ways. They either pick one side and they point to the the Le Romain articles and say, well, this is indicative of how just pro-slavery the Enlightenment was. Or they pick Jaucourt and they say, well, look, this is, you know, this is immensely important. This is how, this is indicative of how just how important the Enlightenment was in the anti-slavery movement. And I think that, you know, both, obviously there's, you know, both are correct. And so that's what I try to do, is to really bring these together and to look, and then my point is not a wholly original one, because other scholars have made it, but the point is that a confrontation was starting to take place in a way that it never had before, in terms of, you know, the place of slavery in society and in politics, that this started to become an essential point of essential contestation by, you know, started to become in the second half of the 18th century, especially, and then obviously, you know, only grows towards the end, especially from the 1780s onwards. This really becomes an open confrontation, obviously. And I think that the Encyclopédie, I put it into the history of the problem, you know, the beginnings of the problematization in European thought of this you know, institution that was so important for a variety of reasons. And that also just reminds me of one other point that I want to make here, which is the tension in Enlightenment thought between the goal to serve a useful institutional administrative function. The fact that, you know, slavery was so embedded by this time in European commerce and politics, even to a certain extent, you know, we can't, we have to also include that in a history of thinking about slavery and anti-slavery. The fact that Enlightenment thinkers were also contributing to this growing state apparatus of serving a useful kind of state function, at the same time that they were also critiquing many aspects of the tradition into which they were, you know, contributing. So this is I think something that is really essential to understanding some of the tensions in Enlightenment thought. These two sides of that, of sort of serving this useful function and then critiquing systems of oppression, which they, you know, to a greater or lesser extent did, depending on who you look at.
And I suppose some of those critiques really come to a head then in your final chapter, where you turn to look at the final of your encyclopedias, which is the, I suppose, in many respects, lesser known Encyclopédie de Verdun, which was produced by the Italian Protestant emigre Fortunato de Felice. And I was wondering if you might start by just kind of explaining how or why the Yverdon Encyclopedia really differed from its French counterpart, and maybe how this was actually kind of manifesting itself in the new edition, perhaps in a number of the articles, or perhaps in the tone of some of the views on equality.
Yeah, of course. So the most important thing to mention about the Encyclopédie de Verdun is its closeness to the Paris original, in the sense that it started out as a re-edition, a reworking by De Felice and his collaborators, but De Felice was the sole editor. I say that it's closest because they used a system a notation to indicate to the reader what they had done to the original. So they put an N beside articles that were completely new, an R, beside articles that were altered. Sometimes they would put an asterisk at the end of an article when they would add a new paragraph or a new section. And the fact that this system worked indicates that, you know, there was a great overlap between the Diderot d'Alembert's Encyclopédie and the Encyclopédie de Verdun. You know, that said, many of the lengthier articles, most of them were reworked, or, you know, they were completely new articles added. And when I say reworked, they were like completely different. They were absolutely, the original was absolutely discarded, and a completely different and new article was written. And in terms of sort of the different kind of tone and flavor of the work, it's very much in a Protestant, Enlightenment Protestant tradition. so you know, there's been great scholarship on various strands of the Christian Enlightenment, and I profited immensely from that. And it can, you know, this encyclopedia can very much be placed in that tradition. So in the sense that they attempt to create a rational Christianity that is respectful of other cultures and traditions, and that is more in that is in tune with some of the key developments in Enlightenment thought. So they don't shy away from engaging with religious and cultural difference. And they very much approach it in an open way. So it's not, you know, it's not an overly evangelical encyclopedia or something. I mean, it's for example, De Felice himself, in one of his articles, he actually writes that missionaries, they actually should not be really active in the non-Christian world, because people have to decide themselves when they are kind of ready to accept the gospel, he essentially says. And this is very, you know, indicative of the Enlightenment approach in terms of the respect for basic autonomy and cultural difference. So that's, you know, an essential part of the work. But it inflects the, it's nonetheless very important, I mean, the Christian tradition, in the sense that for the Encyclopédie Diderot, in a way that it wasn't for many of Diderot and d'Alembert's, themselves and their collaborators, at least some of the key ones, in the sense that they, for example, when it comes to equality, Jaucourt doesn't mention scripture at all, whereas in his article Natural Equality, whereas De Felice has an entire section on what Christian scripture tells us about equality, i.e., we all are created in God's image, we all have a rational soul, we all have souls, and a rational one, and you know this, and so. And then it's sort of interesting, sort of the I think he concludes, if I remember correctly, that article with something like, it's nice to see that the principles of natural philosophy correspond so well to those of the gospel. So it's very much a work trying to be, you know, a work of synthesis in terms of using some of the more secular human sciences as they're developing in the 18th century, you know, combining that with a Christian tradition, and so that's very, you know, that's very clear in a variety of articles. But nonetheless, you know, as I said, the reason why it's an enlightened Christian tradition is because it's you know, it takes autonomy seriously. It's very concerned with toleration. So toleration is a key good. So despite their desire to consolidate Protestantism, you know, there's a very strong defense of religious toleration.
And it's really interesting, this kind of comparison between the two Francophone encyclopedias here, because I think something that you really draw attention to is, you say that, you know, in Yverdon, they were also relying, for example, on Buffon's natural history in terms of racial classification, especially when it comes to sub-Saharan Africans, you know, much in the same way that Diderot was doing in Paris. But what's so fascinating is that you say that in spite of this similarity, in spite of using that same kind of natural history underpinning, the Swiss actually presented a much more forceful abolitionist argument throughout the Encyclopédie. And I was wondering maybe if you could explain this difference, you know, how this came about and perhaps some of the repercussions of this particular reworking, I suppose, of Buffon's classification.
Sure, yeah. So the main reason that the Encyclopédie Diverton is more abolitionist than the Parisian original is the fact that De Felice incorporates many passages, lengthy passages from the Histoire des Beaux Arts, and funnily enough, many passages written by Diderot himself. And so This is, as far as I can tell, the most forceful anti-slavery passages in the work, the Encyclopédie de Veron, are from the Histoire des Deux Indes. So, of course, that, well-known bestseller authored by Reynal, Guillaume Thomas Reynal, but official, or so, to the public, it was a sole authored work, but we now know that it was actually a multi-authored work, of which, Diderot wrote, I believe, somewhere around a quarter of the sort of what's considered sort of standard edition from 1780 from Geneva. There were a number of other philosophes who contributed. And this is what's so fascinating, I guess, about looking at anti-slavery discourse and race, is that race becomes more solidified as a concept and as a category at the same time that the anti-slavery movement is gaining steam, for example, in the Histoire des Deux Indes, and then also, therefore, in the Encyclopédie de Verdun. And this is part of what I try to show in my book, is that this leads to an interesting conclusion, which is that, race cannot be only understood as a response or a justification of inequality. I emphasize this because in the historiography on race, you see really often this the argument that the origins of race are in the tradition, the oppressive tradition, to justify continuing inequalities. And I don't deny that that is a part of the story that is to be told about the invention of race, because that race was used in such a way. That is absolutely indisputable. But what I try to show in my book is that the fact that the same thinkers who were at the forefront of the anti-slavery movement, like Diderot and like the Encyclopédie de Verdun contributors, they were also contributing to a racialist discourse, means that we have to look more carefully. Race cannot just be an ex post facto explanation for inequality and oppression. There must be more going on here. And so that's what I try to show in my book, is that race was, of course, undoubtedly imbued with Eurocentric aesthetic and moral judgments from the get-go. But in the pre-revolutionary world, it wasn't yet an explanatory factor in an all-encompassing inegalitarian system, and I think that has a fairly straightforward reason, which is that the revolutions hadn't happened yet, so equality didn't, the late 18th century revolutions. So, the American Revolution, of course, was already underway, but the the really momentous ones of the French and Haitian hadn't happened yet, and so equality wasn't yet given constitutional status in a state, and so I try to show that race was partially responding to different problems than a justification for inequality, in the sense that race was also a part of a worldview in which the explanation for the longue durée history, the deep natural history of humanity, had entered a wholly new philosophical and intellectual world, in which the Bible no longer held the final word. And then, so that's the field in which I try to position it, that we have to take seriously the fact that Diderot, Buffon, and many of their collaborators were materialist thinkers. So and this is an essential part of thinking about race, is that Although race is not a biological category, absolutely not, the explanation of human physical diversity in a natural history of humanity that was told outside of the biblical framework, this is how we can make sense of Enlightenment racial classification and why it could stand alongside ideas of basic equality and rights in the same Enlightenment mind, as in a thinker like Diderot, and to a lesser extent, the Yverdon encyclopedists. Because although they were not absolutely not materialist thinkers, I think by this time they also would have, they used Buffon and other Enlightenment naturalists to tell a story of the history of humanity, even outside of the biblical framework. I mean, by this time, they had left a literal interpretation of the Pentateuch.
And you do really pick up then in the conclusion on a lot of these themes that you've just mentioned. And I think it's worth drawing attention to something that you say here, where you say, although race was an Enlightenment language of difference and sometimes of inequality, it did not yet serve as an explanation for inequality. And rather then you go on to argue that conjectural history was actually a much more powerful framework for inequality in the examples that you've looked at. And then you obviously kind of go on to think a little bit more broadly about how this then goes on to give way to racial theories and languages and classification in a much more kind of strict scientific way. Yeah. We've come to our hour, and to leave you with an afternoon free of having to kind of talk about your book, I wonder if I might press you to talk about, well, what comes next? Where does the book lead? What is kind of the flavor of research that, this exploration has led you to kind of think about now, and where you might be going with it in the future?
Right. No, thank you. Well, I'm actually not sick of the Enlightenment or equality or race, but I'm mainly sticking with equality. I'm not sick of those things yet, but because what I'm looking at now is equality as a social practice. So the book led me, it's a very intellectual contextualist, or at least I hope it's a contextualist history, intellectual history. That's what I intended it to be. And but in the process of writing it, I absolutely love intellectual history, but I became a bit unsatisfied with the capacity of intellectual history to give indications as to why equality started to matter more to 18th century Europeans in a way that it didn't in previous centuries or generations. And so I think that has a lot to do with the rise of capitalism and the rise of the public sphere, which are, of course, are topics that have been, especially the public sphere, has been explored at great length by many various scholars over the past few decades. But what I hope is at least somewhat new of what I'm doing is to merge the intellectual with the sphere of social practices, and to look at how equality was not just an idea, but intimately bound up with new social practices. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at cafes and theaters in 18th century Paris, and trying to reconstruct the ways in which acts of subordination, let's say, that were inherent in the society of orders that was the Ancien Régime, how those kinds of daily acts became problematic and why. And so that's what I'm, that's what I'm investigating now, and I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, well, I hope we might have you back on the podcast to talk about that in the near future. The book, listeners, is The Color of Equality, Race and Common Humanity in Enlightenment Thought, published by University of Pennsylvania Press in 2021. Devon Vartiya, thank you so much for being on the network today.
Thank you so much for having me, and it was my pleasure.